Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's session is entitled Children with Rare Neuroimmune Disorders, Understanding Medical, Educational, and Social Considerations with Dr. Benjamin Greenberg, Associate Professor of Neurology at UT Southwestern, who leads the TM and NMO Center, and Dr. Lana Harder, Assistant Professor at UT Southwestern. My name is Roberta Peche, and I'm the Research and Project Manager at the Transverse Myelitis Association. Hosting today will be Chitra Krishnan, Executive Director of the TMA. Chitra, can you tell our listeners about the TMA?
Sure. Thank you, Roberta. The TMA is a nonprofit. We support and advocate for people with rare neuroimmune diseases. These diseases include transverse myelitis, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, NMO, or neuromyelitis optica, and optic neuritis. We support research and education programs to increase awareness, to improve our understanding of these diseases with the goal to develop novel therapies to help individuals living with these illnesses.
Thank you, Chitra. A few housekeeping pieces before we get started. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis.
Great. Thank you, Roberta. Thank you, Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Harder, for giving us your time and sharing your experience with our community. We've received several questions. Thank you to our community for sending them in. We will do our best to address these questions focused on pediatric neuroimmune diseases with a specific emphasis on educational, cognitive, and social considerations. To start us off, Dr. Greenberg, would you give us a quick overview on how these diseases differ in kids than adults? And in your experience, what are some of the significant challenges parents should be aware of?
Absolutely. First, let me say thank you, Chitra, to yourself and Roberta and the TMA for sponsoring this, and Dr. Harder for giving her time. I think these podcasts are a wonderful way to exchange information. Your question is a good one relative to the differences between children and adults with these diseases. And in a broad level, we know that there are different distributions of these conditions among kids and adults, but one of the unique challenges for children affected by transverse myelitis, neuromyelitis optica, or ADEM, is just the stage of their life, both biologically and socially, that they are in. As we develop as human beings, our childhood and adolescence are critically important for the development of our personalities, our notions of self and others, our social interactions, and our physical development, how we learn everything from walking to moving to vision and interpreting the world. So interfering with that development through damage changes the trajectory of things, and we have to pay attention to the impact physically, emotionally, as well as socially. We run into issues with siblings and families and schools, things that we just don't deal with on the adult side. And so there's a unique twist to the holistic care of a patient when they are still in that age of development.
Right. Thank you. And Dr. Harder, before we dive into specific questions from our community, would you share with us sort of an overview of your research and what we understand about psychosocial manifestations of what is largely a spinal cord disease, like transverse myelitis, and sort of particularly with an emphasis in children?
Absolutely. I also want to thank all of you and the TMA for having me today. This area has grown into a primary area of research interest for me. And as a neuropsychologist, most of my previous efforts have been focused on pediatric patients with this obvious brain-based pathology. But working with NMO and TM patients has truly challenged my understanding of central nervous system injury and the ways in which these conditions may impact an individual on a cognitive level, even when our traditional MRI techniques don't necessarily show that brain involvement. When our research journey began back in 2009, I didn't expect to see the cognitive and school-related challenges that we're seeing in some of our rare neuroimmune disease patients. For example, we initially found that about 35% of our patients with transverse myelitis were experiencing these school-related problems, so struggling particularly with grades. And what struck us about this was that our patients with multiple sclerosis, patients who have obvious brain-based involvement, were experiencing school problems at almost exactly the same rate. And so this surprising finding led us to investigate the cognitive functioning in TM to understand if that could explain what we were seeing in school. So in our study, we found that a portion of pediatric TM patients exhibited problems in the areas of attention and memory, areas that are really of significant importance for classroom learning. So based on our findings, we now know that pediatric patients with TM are at risk for cognitive and school problems, and this is something we screen for very carefully at our clinic here at Children's Medical Center in Dallas.
So what are some of the therapies and or exercises that can help with memory issues? And there's a second part to this question that that one of our members posted from Philadelphia. Can memory or cognitive issues sort of develop or worsen years after the initial neuroimmune disease diagnosis?
Great questions, and questions that are actually coming up more and more. I'll take the first part. So what are some therapies and or exercises that can help with memory issues? Well, there are two general approaches to this idea of what we call cognitive rehabilitation. So we have what's known as the restorative approach and the compensatory approach. With the restorative approach, these things tend to involve activities, exercises, techniques that reinforce or strengthen a given function, like memory. To my knowledge, this has not been studied in TM, NMO, or ADEM. This is an area that we hope will receive research attention in the near future, as it is much needed to answer this question. More often, the compensatory approach is what is utilized in our setting. This involves teaching strategies to allow a person to adapt to his or her difficulty. So I'll give you some examples of that. Using a planner or an organizer to enhance planning and organization skills, or help with memory, help you remember what to do at a given time during the day. Other things might be the use of a smartphone that has reminders or alarm systems that cue an individual to do something at a particular time, like take medication, or that it's time to leave for therapy, something like that. I should say, though, that it's really important to understand the nature of a person's memory or cognitive issues when designing these interventions. So certainly this isn't a one-size-fits-all approach. But one way that we do this is through neuropsychological evaluation. This allows us to better understand an individual and his or her specific strengths and weaknesses. With this knowledge in mind, we can use that information to determine what interventions are appropriate for that person. Then, go ahead.
And sorry, just to continue on that same trend of thought. So when it comes to schools, do schools have mechanisms in place, or should a parent advocate to have certain mechanisms in place to help?
Absolutely. I know that we recently posted a blog, a Back to School blog, where we outlined everything from things parents should know about the law surrounding with students with disabilities, and to specific interventions that may be useful for patients experiencing cognitive difficulties, say with attention. Sometimes it can make a big difference to allow that person to sit near the front of the classroom to block out distractions. Oftentimes, these students would benefit from extended time when taking exams or completing assignments, to altering their classroom schedule so that they can be most alert, say, at the beginning of the day, and they could stack the core academic courses at that time. So there are a number of different strategies that can be provided in a school setting, and I really encourage the parents of children who are showing some of these school-related difficulties to speak with their schools and their administrators about how to go about setting up these types of services.
Great, thank you. And second part of the question was to remind you about, can these symptoms develop or worsen years after the initial diagnosis?
Yes, and this is a great question. So what do we expect in terms of the evolution? What does this picture look like over time? And at this point, we're still learning what to expect over time. So fortunately, our longitudinal study of cognition in rare neuroimmune diseases is underway. So, with that information, we're going to be able to start to answer these questions. But I will make a few points that I think are important to consider. Dr. Greenberg alluded to this earlier, working with young individuals, we always want to consider the age and developmental stage of the child at the time that the onset of the disease occurred. So thinking about how did the disease onset, how will that affect developmental trajectories or cognitive trajectories going forward. So in some ways, we might guess that this could alter those trajectories. If a child is young at the time of an injury or insult, sometimes we see that individual might, what we call, grow into the difficulties. In other words, in kindergarten or early elementary school, the child may be able to function just fine, much like their other peers in the areas of learning and so on. However, as school demands increase over time, we may start to see more difficulties emerge. And a good example of that might be the student who is entering middle school or high school. This is a time when, you know, students are expected to be more organized and self-directed, and it can be at those points that we start to see significant struggling. When we complete these serial neuropsychological evaluations, we're able to monitor cognition over time and really determine if a person is making progress relative to themselves, say, you know, looking at baseline testing compared to testing a year or two later. And also, we can determine if they're performing according to these age-related expectations that we're talking about. Each person is different, so again, that evaluation is really highly recommended to monitor that functioning over time.
Great, thank you. In talking about worsening after initial neuroimmune diagnosis, this is a question for you, Dr. Greenberg. The reader writes, I am 14 and have had recurring TM since I was 7 years old. Each time it seems to be getting more intense. Is there anything other than immunosuppressants that would help me to not have another relapse? Is there anything that is being developed?
Sure. This is an important question and brings up a couple things. First, around diagnosis. So whenever we have somebody who's had transverse myelitis and then has recurring symptoms over time, we always have to make sure that they're having new relapses versus what are called pseudo-exacerbations. So once there's been damage to the spinal cord, patients can re-experience symptoms over and over and over again without new inflammation being present. And so often we will do MRIs or even spinal taps to look for evidence of new inflammation. If indeed somebody is having recurrent inflammatory events and not just the return of symptoms, then there are a couple mechanisms that people can use to prevent future attacks. So one of them is immunosuppression, and there's a variety of ways to do that, a lot of different medications. The choice of medication, however, is based on the feeling about underlying conditions. Sometimes people have recurrent transverse myelitis because of a disease called neuromyelitis optica. Sometimes it's because of a disease called Sjogren's, and depending on what diagnosis is made would dictate what drug to use. A additional way, not taking the place of immunosuppression, but an additional way to try and reduce the risk of recurrent autoimmune attacks is to aggressively follow one's vitamin D levels, D as in David. And there is some literature that suggests patients with low vitamin D levels have a higher risk of recurrent transverse myelitis. So having your vitamin D level checked by your physician and a determination made on supplementation is a worthwhile thing to do. It's worth noting that the vitamin D we use to supplement is specifically vitamin D3. We think it has a much better effect than vitamin D2. And finally, it's worth noting that there are some patients, very rarely, but some, who get diagnosed with transverse myelitis or recurrent transverse myelitis who indeed actually have a different condition. The most common example of a misdiagnosis in this situation would be in a patient who actually has a blood flow problem of the spinal cord, something called an arteriovenous malformation or dural AV fistula, which is an abnormal connection between arteries and veins around the cord leading to blood flow problems. The presentation, the MRI, can all look just like transverse myelitis, but instead of it being an autoimmune attack, it's a blood flow issue, and often patients can have these events recurrent over time. It's very important that clinicians look carefully at MRIs and carefully at a patient and their history and their presentation to determine, is there a need to look for an alternate diagnosis other than transverse myelitis? So first things first, make sure the diagnosis is correct. If it is recurrent myelitis inflammation, using a combination of immunosuppression and things like vitamin D can be quite helpful.
And, you know, in the similar vein, questions continues from Norway. Talking about rehabilitation, is there a separate sort of rehabilitation paradigm for children versus adults, and also in terms of stem cell research?
Okay, so two questions there. One, welcome to our listeners from Norway. It's great to have an international presence on these calls. The rehabilitation paradigm for transverse myelitis in kids is very similar to adults, with some distinct differences depending on the age of the child. So the similarities. We at our center are big believers in this notion of activity-based rehabilitation therapy. So it's not as useful to lift weights and push weights with your legs if you want to learn to walk again as it is to walk with guidance, and whether it be bracing, whether it be electrical stimulation, work that brings back the normal mechanics of walking. Now, for children, often we have to get a little creative, especially with our younger kids, on how do we get our patients to engage in therapy. Frankly, it's hard enough to get adults to engage in therapy. It takes a huge commitment and a lot of willpower and a lot of dedication with all of the unique social aspects of childhood, needing to go to school, needing to lead a normal life with peers and go out and relax and enjoy the world at that age. We have to find a way to integrate a rigorous daily physical therapy regimen. So a lot of what we do circles around trying to find those places to integrate. Can there be sports that can be used for therapy? We highly recommend swimming. We have one of our patients who's part of a swim team and combines his after-school curricular activities with part of his rehabilitation, which is great. But finding ways to engage our pediatric patients in the rehabilitation is important. And for the really young kids, trying to turn as much of this into games as possible so that they are enjoying therapy and not dreading it is important, because it's a long-term, potentially lifelong commitment to daily activity. The second part of the question was about stem cell research. And stem cell research continues to progress, and I will caution everybody on the call to start tracking stem cell research in two different ways. So the traditional way of thinking about stem cell research is a person who has had damage comes in, I inject or administer stem cells to them, and those cells repair damage. That's one model of restoration of function, repairing damage. The second model, which is further along than the first, is to administer medications to patients that activate their own native stem cells to go in and cause repair. That research for diseases that affect the myelin sheath, the insulation around neurons in the brain and spinal cord, that research has made it to the point of clinical trials. Now, these trials with two different medications are happening in humans currently who have been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, but there are talks underway with the companies and with others to transition these trials into transverse myelitis. So there may be a day, hopefully in the not too distant future, where there'll be trials to administer drugs to turn on a patient's own stem cells to repair. So it's coming. Obviously, we want it to come as fast as possible, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done relative to measuring how beneficial are these therapies.
That's great. That's very hopeful. There were a couple of questions from England and Scotland. Both were related to the use of Botox. One was related to the use of Botox to help with spasms, and the other was related to bladder control. Do you have experience having administered Botox, and would you be able to share what your success rates have been and any other treatments you recommend?
Sure. They're good questions. So first, for full disclosure, I do refer patients for Botox injections both to physiatrists, rehabilitation doctors, and to urologists when we're doing Botox into the bladder. I myself do not personally administer it. It's not a hard thing to do. It's just a skill set I've never gone after, and trust colleagues to help do the actual procedure. Deciding about when it should be used and when it shouldn't be used is actually difficult. It's completely an art form. Two different injectors can get two very different responses. On the side of helping with spasms, in general, we tend not to use it for episodic spasms. Rather, we use it for fixed increased tone in a muscle group that we want to loosen up. So if somebody is doing well, but they have a tight calf muscle or a tight thigh, we may inject there to loosen up that muscle group to allow for better interactions with physical therapy. If somebody is episodically having a spasm of the muscle, it tends not to be our first choice. There are instances where that's not the case. But when we're using it for muscle tone, our success rate is pretty good, but that is measured over multiple attempts at injection over time. So just because a first injection doesn't give us the desired results doesn't mean the next won't. And so it's about finding which muscle group to inject to get the desired result. Relative to the bladder, we've had a lot of good success. For patients who have a neurogenic bladder where they're constantly having urgency to go, needing to empty their bladder on a frequent basis or catheterize on a frequent basis, or having episodes of incontinence because of bladder spasm, Botox injections in the bladder can be quite helpful, and we have a good success rate. But we warn all of our patients that there is a potential for a period of time for someone to have an inability to empty their bladder. The bladder gets so loose and weak that patients have to use a catheter. It doesn't happen all the time, but we warn all of our patients to be prepared for the need of weeks or even a few months of catheterizing after a Botox injection to the bladder in case the bladder gets too loose. When it's dosed correctly, which is an art form and trial and error, we've had a lot of success with Botox in the bladder controlling bladder spasms.
That's very helpful. And switching gears, instead of going between medical symptomatic issues that people have posed as questions and between cognitive depression and other social considerations that people have also asked about. So this one's for you, Dr. Harder. This is a question from New Hampshire. It says, my son was diagnosed with TM 12 years ago and suffers from depression. I'm looking for support groups or phone support in the New England, New Hampshire area. He's now 19, and regular counseling has not helped. Would you be able to share for our listeners about the role of depression in these rare neuroimmune diseases and sort of mechanisms that you have experience with in treating patients?
Yes, absolutely. This question does come up a bit as well. So we know that depression is an area that could impact quality of life, cognitive functioning, lots of different areas. So as part of the evaluation process, we're looking very carefully at multiple areas of functioning, and mood is one of those. In the area of TM and depression, our research is really in its infancy. We are finding that patients with TM may be at slightly greater risk for the development of depression when compared to same-age peers. So this is an area that we're hoping to learn more about over time. We know that there are different types of treatment modalities to address depression. And like I've said a couple of times by now, each person is really different. So we want to address the symptoms as they come up. And so for a 19-year-old with transverse myelitis and depression, we want to look at ways to support that individual. So support groups absolutely can be very helpful, you know, connecting with another group of people that might be experiencing some of the same challenges, whether it be specifically related to TM or depression itself or a spinal cord injury. Often when we can put those folks together to work through the difficulties, it can be very powerful. That's actually a large part of what we do at our TMA family camp. And I believe that that has a powerful impact on the children and families who attend. So, support groups can be very helpful. And because TM is so rare, it's probably unlikely that there would be a support group specifically geared for individuals with a specific medical condition. But again, it may be worth looking for groups focused on young adults who are facing depression, or support groups for broader groups of patients with spinal cord injuries. Also, if this individual happens to be a student, there are often resources that may be available on campus through a counseling and mental health center. So those are some ideas there. I do want to address the point about individual counseling. I would say that when considering this as a treatment modality, it's extremely important to consider the patient's openness to this process, as well as the patient-therapist fit. So it's really crucial that a therapist and patient have this open and collaborative relationship that promotes the therapeutic process, allowing the patient to have a safe and confidential place to discuss concerns. Sometimes finding the right therapist is actually a large key to success in this area, so that's something to consider. And then finally, while individual or group therapy may be adequate to treat some individuals with depression, for others, this treatment modality is not sufficient. And in this case, medication may be beneficial. So I just wanted to note that, for some, and often in more severe cases, medication can alleviate symptoms enough to allow the individual to engage in therapy or other activities that might improve mood, like social activities, exercise, things like that. So consultation with a physician would be the most important first step toward determining if a trial of medication might be appropriate.
And, along the same lines, when you're talking about sort of being in a support group, say, for example, with spinal cord injury patients or other young adolescent groups who may not, share the same disease mechanism as transverse myelitis, but, their depression is a different process, say, for example. Do you think that difference could in any way discourage people or be helpful or not helpful?
That's a really good question. And, of course, there is no research that gives us this answer. We always start with the research when we try to anticipate an answer to a question like this. So, I really do, again, emphasize individual differences, and for someone like this 19-year-old, that it may be worth trying those things out to see. I mean, one of the usual goals for a group like that would be to identify coping strategies, identify tools that are helpful, and within a group setting, it's wonderful because individuals offer ideas about what has worked for them, and so it's a time that they can learn from one another. And, of course, the point that you make, I mean, these individuals may be quite different in the types of things that they're working to address or to cope with, but it would be those coping tools that I think would be of value to the individual participants, even if the problem isn't the same.
Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you. And Dr. Rimba, what about, medicines or medications that will help with chronic fatigue from these diseases? Can you share more about managing fatigue and the side effects of using medications that cause fatigue?
Sure. Fatigue is a common complaint in our clinics among TM patients, both children and adults. And we often find that it's mediated by a lot of different factors. And so the first thing to recognize is fatigue as a symptom usually doesn't come from just a singular cause. In our transverse myelitis patients, it may be a manifestation of the fact that they expend more energy with every step they take. If you have to think about walking from point A to point B and think about your mechanics and balance, it takes more energy to achieve that goal. So a lot of our patients will be fatigued early in the day because of the expending of energy. And so when that's the case, this is where physical therapy comes in. If we can adopt strategies or devices to make walking easier, people have more energy. The best example of this are patients who have a mild foot drop that they can compensate for So they don't want to wear a brace, an ankle brace, to keep their toes up. And because they don't like it, either because of the way it looks or feels or a variety of things. And we work hard to get something that is under clothes, not obvious, and fits in shoes. But the reason we stress its importance is because if we can make that single step easier, you will have more energy later in the day. The next area where we see issues with fatigue or contributions to fatigue are relative to sleep issues, especially among our adolescents and our teenagers, who notoriously just normal adolescents have different sleep patterns. We all remember staying up later and burning the candle at both ends. The impact, however, of a lack of sleep catches up to our TM patients faster than the average adolescent or teenager. And so we spend a lot of time focusing on sleep cycles and making sure people are getting complete normal sleep patterns, because this is a big way to help battle fatigue. And then we look at, thirdly, lifestyle. Exercise can help reduce fatigue. It sounds strange because it takes energy, but over the course of life, a regular exercise routine is a great way to battle fatigue. And then diet plays a big role. Most of us, at least in America, and definitely our teenagers, don't always have the healthiest diets. There's a lot of fast food or processed foods or foods high in sugars that lead to short-term energy help, but long-term energy depletion. And so we really push for people to try and focus on what they're eating, because it can make a big difference in how they feel and how much fatigue they do or don't have. And then finally, and you asked it in your question, the role of medications. It is extremely common for the medications we use to treat symptoms in transverse myelitis to lead to side effects such as fatigue. Pretty much all of the medicines we use to manage spasticity can have a side effect of fatigue. Some antidepressants can have a side effect of fatigue. And so we monitor very carefully and have to make calculated decisions on those risk-benefit situations. There may be a drug like baclofen, for example, that helps loosen muscles up but give our kids fatigue. And we have to decide what's the lowest dose we can get away with, and are there ways to manage the fatigue and yet maintain the benefit of the medication. Sometimes we have to find alternate ways to manage spasticity, like Botox, in order to avoid the side effect of fatigue. And these are reasonable decisions that can be discussed and made with treating physicians. But it's important to recognize that sometimes we have to take the side effect of the medication while exploring other ways to manage the fatigue level. But I always encourage people to discuss options with their clinicians. We've had patients who've gotten certain pumps that bring medication directly into their spinal fluid, just so they can avoid taking a pill that comes with side effects. There are a variety of ways to manage the pros and cons of these medications, but sometimes it takes some creative conversations. I will say, relative to fatigue, we often underestimate the role of diet and exercise relative to this. As we get patients who truly commit to changing diet, really watching what they eat, and really being serious about what we're putting in our bodies, a lot of these symptoms tend to become more manageable.
That's great. And in terms of managing fatigue when it comes to school and activities, how does that impact kids, Dr. Harder?
Yes, this is coming up a lot in our TM and cognition paper. We actually concluded that fatigue was an area that we suspect is relates to cognitive functioning. So this is a really big, important topic that we're hoping to understand and study further. In terms of school-based activities, of course, you know, talking with physicians to learn about ways to address this from a medical perspective is key. And following that, there are a number of behavioral things that can also be helpful. Like Dr. Greenberg spoke about, you know, this idea of managing sleep. So establishing a regular and structured schedule, which we know has benefits for all or most kids, is especially important here. So I would emphasize, you know, good sleep hygiene. So regular and consistent bedtimes and wake times, avoiding naps if that's going to keep the person up late at night, avoiding those bright lights and electronic devices shortly before it's time to go to sleep, things like that. I alluded to this before, but scheduling core academic classes early in the day, if possible, may be beneficial for some. So if the person is most likely to be alert early in the day, then stacking those classes early in the morning can be helpful. Also, allowing students to take regular breaks during the day during a given activity, that is a recommendation we give. And just those small breaks can make a big difference in a person's stamina throughout the day. Other things that may help preserve energy include having an elevator pass if that's something that would allow a student to avoid stairs if they're taking the stairs, providing students with an extra set of books for home so that they're not carrying a heavy backpack to and from school each day. Certainly working with physical therapists to adapt PE activities. These are all things that that may be useful in the school setting when it comes to managing fatigue.
Great. And would you recommend neuropsych testing for all children impacted by neuroimmune diseases or just people who are, say, showing symptoms that you think they should get tested?
So, I do think that neuropsychological evaluation is important for these patients, if nothing else, a screening evaluation, which is the model we use at Children's in Dallas. So it's about 45 minutes to an hour of a screening battery looking at cognitive, behavioral, emotional, fatigue, all of these kinds of symptoms we've been talking about today, also looking at school-related issues. That's not always going to be a possibility, which I understand. So I would say that for individuals who, parents especially, suspecting cognitive issues or noticing school-related declines, poor grades, things like that, I would say it is worth a discussion with your physician to determine if a neuropsychological assessment is warranted. And I think that now we have enough information to really support that idea for these patients.
Great, thank you. A couple of medical questions for you, Dr. Greenberg. This one comes from Orlando, Florida. Our now 17-month-old son was diagnosed with TM at 9.5 months of age. He cannot crawl or walk, but can sit and stand for several seconds without support. How do we know if he has feeling in his toes and legs? We don't think he has feeling, yet he can stand.
Yeah, this is a excellent question, and the person supplying it's picking up on some real nuances to issues around pediatric transverse myelitis. So the first is, in this age group, the recovery is very different. The process of recovery is very different than in the older age group. As if I take a human being who has learned to walk, and I take away their ability to walk, their pathway to rehabilitation follows one trajectory. If I take an infant who has not yet learned to walk, and I give them transverse myelitis, they, from that point on, have to learn to walk for the first time with a different central nervous system. And that's a challenge. It's a different type of challenge, and it takes a lot of dedication from physical therapy and from families on daily work to try and get the body to develop that walking pattern for the first time, yet with a system that isn't operating at peak proficiency. So how do you find out if he has feelings in his toes and legs? Well, frankly, this is where a neurologist can come in and do some simple tests to see if there is basic sensation. Sometimes it's applying a very small, not harmful, painful stimulus, a small pinprick, for example, like as if you were going to take blood, to see if he can respond to it and has that type of sensation. Unfortunately, that type of sensation is not the most critical for walking. What's most critical for walking is impossible to test in children this age, and it's something called proprioception. When everyone who's on the call right now listening is either standing or sitting or maybe pacing around, And their brains, all of our brains, know exactly where our feet are in space. We have this mental map of where our feet are sitting or standing or moving at this moment. And that mental map is based on proprioception. Your brain has to know where your feet and legs are in space in order to walk normally. The way I test this in the clinic with older children or adults is to take their toe or finger, have the patient close their eyes and wiggle it up or down, and the patient tells me which direction I'm moving it. And that is my measure of proprioception. At 17 months old, we can't do that test. And so we have to look for other subtle signs to see if he is able to know where his legs are in space. And frankly, it may just not be possible. That said, this is where physical therapists and physiatrists come in, targeted to pediatric populations who've had this disease. We work here with a physical therapist named Melanie Farrar, who's wonderful, and it's looking for subtle signs to determine what's going to be the best therapy routine for that kiddo. And really, it's coming up with ways to get them to practice the skill set. So for someone who can sit and stand for seconds without support, which is great and a great sign. If he can sit and even stand for those seconds, it means the signal's getting through. And now we need to get him to push his legs to move more. And that means turning it into a game and placing things that he wants outside of his reach and getting him to crawl or walk to them. And sometimes it can seem mean, and you have to be trained and know the rules of how long can you do this before it does become mean or create a negative impact on the child. And these are where the physical therapists who spend time with kids these ages become incredibly important, whether it be at the center here in Dallas or at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore. If families are ever looking for referrals for therapists in their area, I encourage them to reach out to the TMA or either of these centers or to other families to find out where in your region have you found therapists who are uniquely skilled at that age group, because it's very important to partner up with somebody who has experience with this unique set of needs.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And then the one question that you know, we always get asked is about vaccinations, and I have actually two questions regarding. One is with reference to the flu shots, if people should get them. And the second is, this one's also from Norway, any relation between vaccines and onset of TM? Her daughter was diagnosed at 18 months of age, and she probably got the swine flu vaccine. I hope I'm reading that right. And they said they just won against the government. So any thoughts or any, do we know anything about the relation between swine flu vaccine and autoimmunity, and what are your recommendations about getting a flu shot after, both in children and perhaps even in adults too, after a diagnosis of TM or NMO?
Dr. Harder, you don't want to take this one? Are you?
<I'll>
you. Oh, well, okay, fine. Vaccinations and transverse myelitis are obviously a well-known and controversial area. I will tell you the data we have and the data we don't. Overwhelmingly, the data says that vaccination is safe, both in terms of people who have never had transverse myelitis. It is the relative risk of an immune-mediated adverse event like TM is exquisitely small, and I'll put some numbers around this. And in patients who have had transverse myelitis, we actually recommend still getting flu shots based on whatever the national recommendations in your country of origin are at that moment. So in the United States, children of school age should get their flu shots. And here are the reasons why. When there has never been a single study to show an association between vaccination and transverse myelitis. There are case reports, and I have patients in whom a flu vaccination was obtained, and at some point after that vaccination, transverse myelitis developed. Here's the problem with case reports. So let's assume that after being exposed to the flu vaccine, we are going to just say that for anyone who gets transverse myelitis within 90 days, that it may have a relationship. Well, We get the flu vaccine every year, and that means for 25% of the time on Earth, for everyone who gets flu vaccines, they'd be at risk for TM. If you do it at 60 days, it'd be 1/6 of the time. When we play with these numbers, we do not see a spike in transverse myelitis cases after the months of flu vaccination. The next piece of evidence that argues against a link is taken from our colleagues who work on multiple sclerosis. Now, the theory that links vaccinations to transverse myelitis says that you get exposed to a vaccine, your immune system gets activated by the vaccine, and there's something in the vaccine that looks like a spinal cord, so that your immune system goes on to attack the brain, or in this case, the spinal cord. The problem with that theory is if you take multiple sclerosis patients who already have a confused immune system, they have an immune system that is dying to get in and cause damage to a spinal cord, would love to get in and cause damage to a brain. When we looked at tens of thousands of patients, or over 10,000 patients, I should say, of MS patients who had gotten the flu vaccine versus not, there was no difference in relapse rates after the flu vaccine. Did people have a relapse of MS after a flu vaccine? Absolutely. During the same period of time, unvaccinated, did an equal number of people have relapses? Absolutely. So it was by chance that the relapse happened in the days or weeks or months following the flu vaccine. And if there isn't data to say that this group of patients who have an immune system that would love to cause damage can't be activated by the flu vaccine, it makes it harder to believe that idiopathic or one-time-only transverse myelitis is linked. Now, that said, do I believe that there's ever been a case where a vaccine has played a role in an episode of transverse myelitis? I'm sure there may be. It's just an incredibly hard thing to prove. And at a practical level, the safety is so overwhelming, we recommend getting the vaccine. And we do it for a very simple reason. After transverse myelitis, or even without it, in both kids and adults, the effect of actual influenza is far greater than the risk of the vaccine. And so the adults and children who die every year of flu, for which there are tens of thousands of people around the world who die of flu every year, the virus itself is way riskier than the vaccination. So purely on a mathematical basis, it is safer and more prudent to get the vaccine than to risk an exposure to the actual influenza virus.
That is very, very, very helpful, Dr. Greenberg. And what are your thoughts on, this is a question on autonomic nervous system issues after a diagnosis of TM?
So that's a great question. So for those of you who don't know what the autonomic nervous system is, it's the part of your nervous system that controls things like blood pressure and pulse and sweating and your body temperature. It's the things in life that we don't think about. We don't sit back and say, I want my blood pressure to be 120 over 80. We may wish it to be so, but for some of us, it's not. Or we want to lower our pulse or change our body temperature. For some of us on the call who are chronically cold, we would love to be able to say, turn me up by a degree and warm me up. The autonomic nervous system is responsible for all of this. It's the cruise control, the autopilot for how our body's physiology works. The signals that go from your brain to your body and back again are traveling through the spinal cord. And so in transverse myelitis, if the pathways that control that cruise control for the body get damaged, all sorts of funny things can happen to our blood pressure, pulse, sweating, and body temperature. So I'll have patients who tell me that they will randomly feel nauseous and sick and clammy and sweaty, and their blood pressure will change, and they're trying to figure out why, and it turns out that they're constipated. And instead of their brain just feeling abdominal discomfort, it triggers a whole set of changes in their autonomic nervous system. Or they have a urinary tract infection, or they got a cut on their foot, but because they couldn't feel their foot, they didn't have normal pain, but their body picked up on it and set off a cascade of changes in their autonomic nervous system. And so we know that there are changes in how the autonomic nervous system responds to normal stimulations in patients with TM, and it's really important, especially for patients who have had changes in their spinal cord above the mid-thoracic level, so the top half of the spinal cord, those patients in particular are at risk for changes in the autonomic nervous system that can lead to rapid and large changes in blood pressure or pulse. So if you or a family member is dealing with transverse myelitis and having just unexplained changes in blood pressure or pulse that make them feel sick or ill or tired, it's worth testing to see if there is a trigger that is setting off these autonomic changes. It's quite common, and the three most common causes for these changes, for the symptoms of these changes, are constipation, urinary tract infections, and some sort of wound. And so it's always worthwhile to make sure that if you're seeing these changes in blood pressure and pulse or feeling ill for an unexplained reason, check for one of those three things.
Great, thank you. We have, I want to be cognizant of time, but we have two questions on Facebook. One is about B12 deficiency in TM and methylated versus cyanocobalamin. And the second question is, has there been any advancement in treatment for pain or management of pain?
So first was about B12 and transverse myelitis. So we do not. So a B12 deficiency, as far as we know, does not lead to transverse myelitis. We know that there is a condition with B12 deficiency called combined subacute degeneration, which is a condition that can affect the spinal cord and peripheral nerves, can lead to spinal cord damage, but the damage looks somewhat different than transverse myelitis. We know that B12 is an incredibly important building block for the body's myelin production and keeping a healthy spinal cord. So the only link between B12 and transverse myelitis that I'm aware of is if you have transverse myelitis, if you are also B12 deficient, then it can make it harder for your body to repair in theory, or it may even make the injury worse, but the B12 deficiency does not cause the transverse myelitis. And I should stress that those comments about recovery and repair and damage in the setting of B12 deficiency is theory and has never been proven prospectively. The difference between methylcobalamin and cyanocobalamin B12 is unclear. So there are some practitioners, some physicians who feel that the version of B12 called methyl B12 or methylcobalamin is more bioavailable, that once you absorb it, it's ready to go, whereas cyanocobalamin has to be converted in your body. And there's a lot of hype on the internet that this conversion leads to a small amount of cyanide in your body. That is pure hype in terms of that being a health harm. We've seen in long-term studies of large doses of cyanocobalamin no health effects or issues with cyanide poisoning or anything along those lines. And so I don't think people need to rush out and get the methylcobalamin. When we follow B12 levels, both of them get absorbed and can bump a person's B12 level to an appropriate amount. And so either one, I think, is perfectly fine to take. I don't know of any studies saying that there's a unique harm to the cyanocobalamin. And then the next question you had was about pain control.
Pain management.
Pain is a ongoing challenge in transverse myelitis because there are lots of different types of pain, and it takes a true holistic approach to management. Pain has an impact on people's outlook. Pain has an impact on cognition. Pain has an impact on fatigue, depression, and especially in our pediatric patients, can become develop feedback loops with social situations or stressful situations. And so we don't just approach pain control from medication. We try a variety of things. Some pains should be worked out with physical therapists. Some pains are not neuropathic but are orthopedic in nature and need a very different approach. Some pain responds very well to acupuncture, a non-medicinal way to try and get pain control. When patients and families make the commitment to work with psychologists, specialized psychologists in chronic pain management, we often see dramatic gains in pain control with less medication. And so we really do encourage a holistic approach to the pain control, not just a prescription. On the prescription side, there are numerous avenues to pursue, and each one has to be tailored to an individual's patient's type of pain, location of pain, and potential for side effects. But I encourage patients and families, after trying one or two medications that may not work, not to give up. The list is very long, and it takes trial and error, and this is where you need a very good working relationship with your healthcare provider on setting goals and expectations, doing a trial of an intervention, whether it be a medicine or something else, assessing if it worked, and then making a change if it didn't. If you get to a point where you've tried one or two things and your healthcare practitioner says, there's nothing else I can do, then that's a problem, and you need to seek out advice from other sources. The only reason I say that is because the number of options are so large, it is extremely rare for us to say, we're out of options. So I encourage people to really stay committed to trying to find a practitioner you can work with to go through the trials to find something that works. But don't give up on the non-medicinal ways to control pain.
Excellent. I am so grateful to both of you for having spent the last 55 minutes answering these questions from our community. Really, really grateful. Are there any sort of closing thoughts that both that either you, Dr. Greenberg, or Dr. Harder have to share with our community?
I want Dr. Harder to have the last word, so I'm just going to say one quick thing, that the notion of this podcast was about looking at the unique issues that our pediatric patients face. And the one thing I'd like to stress is, especially when it comes to our pediatric patients, all of these issues feed into each other. A bladder that isn't working well interferes with sleep and our teenagers' concern about going to school because for fear of a bladder issue, which impacts their education, which impacts their cognition, and or at least their ability to apply their cognitive capabilities. And so it, in my view, there are a lot of unique features in pediatric TM that requires a team approach, and I think we learned it here in Dallas the best, mainly through Dr. Harder's contributions with her research in clinical care of our patients, that it's we always want to look for one explanation, one cause, one thing to fix, and everything gets better. In most of my patients, I'd say it takes tackling multiple things simultaneously. But I'll turn things over to Dr. Harder, and curious to hear her thoughts.
And this will sort of be echoing what Dr. Greenberg has said. I have learned in these years that I've had the privilege of working in the pediatric demyelinating diseases program at Children's, I've learned what complex challenges come to our clinic. And like Dr. Greenberg said, these are not only complex but interrelated. And so taking the time to prioritize the things that need to be addressed, I think, is really important, not getting overwhelmed by the complexity, but determining a good place to start and using your team to do that. So the primary physician serving your child is a great person to start that conversation with. And even if your team isn't in one place, if you look around, there's the physician, there are teachers at school, a therapist, physical therapist, occupational therapist, possibly a mental health specialist, so many different people that are there to provide support. And so reaching out, I think, to the team members for support is really important. And I think that's all I would say is that, you know, there are lots of things to address, and the needs will change over time. And so it's being able to anticipate that moving target and, again, find the support that you need through the team.
And if I can say, I think that's such a good point, Lana, that the TMA and the families around you, if you are a pediatric patient with TM listening to this, or you're a mother or father or sibling of one, your community, which the TMA helps try to build an infrastructure for communication, is one of the most valuable resources you have. Both the TMA organization and the members of it. We at our center have learned so much. We have learned more from you than I think you have learned from us. And so taking advantage of that community and really trying to troubleshoot together and inform us about what works and what doesn't is an incredibly important part of this process.
Thank you. Thank you both incredibly for this very enlightening and thoughtful conversation. We really appreciate it. We will make this podcast, which has been recorded, available on our website. And we are also going to try and provide a transcript of the podcast so our non-native speakers of English are also able to follow and learn from this podcast. Thank you again very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.